When Election Day draws near in the state of Florida, our guest, the go-to Florida political analyst, will be seen and heard on every radio and TV station around the state. Stay tuned today to get her insider scoop as we move closer towards the 2018 elections. Hi, I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch with the Connection Partners.
And I'm Cher Tanner, Community Coordinator for the Pachamama Alliance Tampa Bay. And we're here on WMNF The Source, welcoming you to our show, Spotlight on Game Changers. This show is all about creating positive connections in the world. Yes, instead of incessantly focusing on all the trouble, doom and gloom you hear about on cable news, our show is the antidote to that. We find the brilliant people solving the most critical and challenging issues facing us today. And this week, we have the pleasure of shining our spotlight on game changer Dr. Susan McManus. She has her fingers on the political pulse in the state of Florida and understands the historical dynamics influencing the politics and issues of our state and the country at large. The purpose of this show is to inspire you, enlighten you, and ignite you, and for you to come away feeling compelled to be game changers too. How do we do it? Our upcoming guest is our secret sauce.
I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch, hosting with Cher Tanner our show Spotlight on Game Changers on WMNF The Source. We use the 10 qualities of a game changer as the backbone of our show. They were developed by the Pachamama Alliance, inspired by cultural historian Thomas Berry's philosophy. He said that the great work of our time is to carry out the transition from the current period when humans can be a destructive presence on Earth to living a mutually enhancing human-Earth relationship. We discussed these 10 qualities of a game changer in detail on our first show, which you can listen to on our Facebook page at Spotlight on Game Changers or in our archives on WMNF homepage, Spotlight on Game Changers. They guide us in choosing our guest. Today, we'll feature the sixth quality. You recognize systems of power and privilege. You recognize that the social injustice and environmental exploitation in our world are not the natural order of things, but rather are the outcome of intentionally designed systems of power and privilege. These systems and structures resist change and lead to further injustice, violence, and suffering.
We like playing an audio clip to set the stage for the conversations with our guests. And I have to tell you, finding one this week was very challenging because we discussed so many different issues with Susan during our conversation. So we decided to feature the issue related to our first question as the conversation began, sexual harassment, hashtag MeToo, and the criminal justice system. Here's the 2-minute clip Colorado sex crimes prosecutors weigh in on hashtag MeToo.
We've reported on sexual harassment claims at the state capitol, and as the MeToo social media campaign raised awareness, workplaces are demanding accountability.
Yeah, but will it change how these cases are treated in the criminal justice system? Sean Boyd live in a Denver courtroom for us tonight. And Sean, these can be tough cases to prove.
Karen, some of the toughest. It's often one person's word against another, and we have a culture of victim blaming. But that narrative has started to shift in the last few weeks. And some of Colorado's top sex crimes prosecutors say it could go a long way toward holding sexual predators accountable.
The Me Too movement has overwhelmingly swayed the court of public opinion, but can it do the same in the court of law?
These cases are not easy, and they're very traumatic for the people involved.
Michael Doherty has prosecuted sex crimes for 20 years. There are thousands every year in Colorado, but only a handful of units dedicated to prosecuting them. Doherty, who's running for attorney general, says for there to be real accountability, that needs to change.
These cases often come down to credibility. So you need to have people with experience who could figure out what actually happened and then what to do about it.
I would not be surprised to see a corresponding spike in some of the reporting.
As Me Too opens the floodgates, Maggie Conboy, who oversees sex crimes at the Denver DA's office, hopes it will also foster more open-minded juries.
People will hopefully understand that there are compelling reasons why people don't talk about these things for many, many years.
I think what we're finally seeing is that this is very prevalent. It crosses all societal boundaries.
And Karen Datz, head of the sex crimes unit in Boulder, says just by empowering victims to break their silence and make a report, it can make a difference.
There is recidivism in this area, and we know that, and so maybe this particular case can't go forward, but if that person ever comes back again, we would want this on record.
I think we should take advantage of this opportunity, of this conversation, of this crisis, to make real positive change.
Among the changes Daugherty says he would make as Attorney General are increasing training for law enforcement and creating a sex crimes unit in the AG's office to help prosecute these crimes statewide.
That was from CBS Denver, published December 1st, 2017.
It is a privilege to introduce Dr. Susan A. McManus, a distinguished university professor of public administration and political science at the University of South Florida. She served for many years as political analyst for WFLA-TV, and since 2016 has been the political analyst for ABC Action News. Susan is the co-author of numerous political books, and she and her mother, Elizabeth, co-authored two local Florida history books. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission and as an advisor to the Florida Division of Elections. Susan was a Fulbright Research Scholar in Seoul, Korea, and received USF's Distinguished Research Scholar Award. She received the Diane Blair Award for Outstanding Achievement in Politics and Government and the Manning Dower Distinguished Florida Political Science Award. She's been a Reuben O'Donovan Askew Fellow of the Florida Institute of Government since 1995. Susan declares herself unaffiliated with any political party. Hello, Dr. McManus. This is Sharon Joy Kleitch, and I'm here with Cher Tanner on WMNF's The Source. We welcome you as our distinguished woman of game-changing today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very honored.
We understand from our engineer, Ira, that you're one of the most interviewed people around Tampa Bay and beyond, and we're very, very honored to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Ira.
I remember back as we went through the transition from 2017 to 2018, Susan, that Rob Lauri asked the guests on his show, Florida This Week, to name what they thought would be a top issue of 2018. If I remember correctly, you said it was going to be sexual harassment. So here we are deep into 2018, and I'm curious, do you still believe that's the case? And what are the signs you see of sexual harassment continuing or changing for this year?
Well, the Me Too movement has really caught on big, and we're seeing the consequences of it in terms of particularly young and professional women choosing to run for political office, often legislative contests in both the state level and even Congress. Obviously, sexual harassment does resonate with all ages of women, but people do vote on that issue differently. Some people, that's the single issue that they vote on. Others, it varies. But is it a continue to be an issue? Of course it does. I think that right now what we're seeing is some struggling, though, as a consequence of the fire with which the Me Too movement spread across the country. We are struggling a bit with legal definitions of sexual harassment as these kinds of things now leave the news arena and go into the courtroom.
I'm struck by your saying the people vote differently in regard to sexual harassment. Expand on that, please.
A lot of it does stem from how people define sexual harassment. Some it's a physical contact, others it's mental.
Ah.
So quite varied there, and therein lies the difference.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that. I'm also curious about something else I heard you speak to at the final series of Restoring Respect, a community conversation at the Cathedral Church of St. Petersburg. And you said that in Florida, there's been a lot of progress in dealing with bullying in the Florida schools. Do you find there's a connection between bullying and sexual harassment then?
I absolutely have seen that in my lifetime, as I'm sure you all have, and I do sense that it's there a bit, depending upon the home life of the individual child as they enter school and how the teachers in schools address those kinds of issues. It's a multifaceted problem in society where some feel compelled to intimidate and make fun of others. I'm a country girl. I grew up with a mother who would not tolerate that kind of behavior. But there are a lot of young children who don't have the home life where they receive that kind of instruction, which is why it's imperative that others in the community and in society and schools try to address the bullying. But also, more importantly, and I think the recent Parkland situation really demonstrated that a lot of bullying can also be traced back to early signs of mental illness or instability that needs to be treated early on before it explodes and get into the situations that we've seen that are so heinous in the violence and shootings like Parkland.
Hi, Susan. This is Cher, and you've touched on an issue that I was really looking forward to hearing your ideas around. You know, here in Florida, of course, since Parkland did happen here, I have to say I was amazed that some action actually took place. And obviously, we have these magnificent Gen Zers we can thank for leading this charge. But I'm curious where you stand with regards to arming teachers. This just seems like such a bizarre idea to me. And also, I'm wondering, do you feel, you know, you talk about how people sometimes really do vote on one issue. Do you feel like this gun issue, in light of what has transpired here, is going to have some sort of a real effect on voting here in the state of Florida at the very least?
I certainly do, but I do think that the issue is going to be differently impacting different parts of the state. So if you grew up in the rural panhandle where guns are regarded as a fact of life, more hunting and entertainment, versus someone who has grown up in an urban environment where guns are equated with violence, the attitudes about guns differ considerably, and that's what makes Florida such an interesting state politically, as we're one of the most diverse states in every way, ideologically, politically, socially, religiously. But for many people that have children in schools, and particularly women, I do believe that the gun issue is going to be a very big issue in the upcoming midterm elections in our state.
Susan, you're such an expert about demographics. I'm fascinated with your percentages that you often quote. Something struck me about the fact that Florida, you said, is a match with the national demographics, as you said, religion, race, ethnicity. So what I want to go to, what are the opportunities if the state of Florida is an example of the demographics of the whole country? How might we model, learn together, some actions that can make a difference regarding this question of guns?
Increasingly, we're seeing that one of the biggest challenges that our country and our state and our community faces is the fact that people communicate differently, especially by generation. But one of the problems that we see even at the university level, and I'm sure at every level, is the difficulty that people have in articulating their views and feelings to others who are different from themselves. I think that is America's biggest challenge right now, is to tap in to the strengths that diversity brings. My style of teaching is that I break my students into groups that are very differently configured, different backgrounds, and so forth, and we tackle big policy issues that are facing our country and our state, and again, our community.
Lots of fistfights in your classes, right?
not really. That's what's really interesting. Not really. Now, mm-hmm. I give stern lectures the first day of informing them that this is your chance in life. You're educated now more than most of America, because still more have not gone to college than go to college. And so this is the one time in your life where you have an opportunity to understand why somebody thinks differently than you. It doesn't mean that you have to agree, but it gives you an opportunity, whether you go into sales or medicine or teaching or whatever profession you go into, you're going to come across different people. And the more that you can understand why people think like they do, and that enables you to better communicate your own views. And I think that communication is really America's number one challenge right now, because mm-hmm. we're not doing a very good job at it.
It's so true. And I love that you reinforce this civil discourse, but now take it outside of the classroom where you don't have your educator that gives you your grade telling you to be good.
Right.
What are some of the strategies that you would recommend for people? Because I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is why we are in this uproar that we see day in and day out from minute to minute, because people are in their silos and they don't even know how to broach that divide. So what are some real strategies that people can try to put in place?
Networking is vital, and the more broad-reaching your networks are, the better it's going to be, because that's one of the few ways that you can break out of silos. But I think a lot of the breaking out is really contingent upon being in situations where people are unified, and that's even if it's momentary. For example, in crises like Hurricane Irma, how many instances did we see of people who didn't really know their neighbor pitching in and helping someone? And those kinds of situations, out of tragedy comes hope. That's one of the things that my grandmother used to talk about. And so, you know, that's those kinds of situations where there's something that people can get together and start to talk in a friendly fashion rather than a competitive fashion, that is very helpful. So we're seeing, for example, in a lot of the Tampa Bay area, strong neighborhood areas where you have block parties or you have let's get together and let's help such and such clean their yard, those kinds of things. Everyday people helping everyday people, and particularly in diverse communities like ours and our state, that's very helpful. But I think that another thing that's really helping a lot is that our public schools and even private schools too, in K through 12, especially high school, are really emphasizing volunteerism. And I see that in college students a lot. They may not be terribly interested or informed about voting, but they're right there when we have a USF Day of Service. They want to get involved. And I think that really helps a lot. It's a challenge, though, because people come from very different viewpoints. Some people feel passionately about their issues, others less so. But we all have to live in the same world, and we really have to work at it hard to bridge bridges that exist.
I just want to let our listeners know that we are talking with Dr. Susan McManus, the best known Florida political analyst around the state. And I'm Cher Tanner here with Sharon Joy Kleitch. We're on WMNF. The Source. So I'm dying to ask you a question. I was so thrilled that we were going to have you as a guest today, because I have to tell you and I know that you go with no political affiliation, but I have to tell you that the 2016 election just blew my mind, and I've been crazy ever since. And right following the election, we had already had previously planned a trip to Dubai and then traveling around different countries in Asia. And so we did that almost immediately following the election. And it was like I was on the American apology tour. I'm not kidding you. Everywhere we went, in every country we were in, all types of different people were saying, what's going on with America? And so, you know, I gave my little lecture about the Electoral College and that one candidate really did win the popular vote. And I will never forget, we were sitting in a restaurant at the Burj Al Arab, and we were telling this, the waitress was asking us when she learned that we were from America. So I went through my whole spiel. I had it pretty well down by that point. And she said, well, then why do you bother to vote? And so my question of you, because I know you're an expert and you really know the Electoral College versus the popular vote, why the heck in 2018 do we still have the Electoral College?
Well, it goes back to the Great Compromise, the formation of the nation. If you recall, you had the big states and you had the small states. And one of the ways that they could form a union was the Great Compromise, and that's the genesis of it again. And the Electoral College uses the same argument. The basis for it was it gives an input into every state as opposed to the popular vote, which would really, you could campaign in six of the largest states and win elections. So there's arguments on both sides of it. Polls repeatedly show that most people would prefer the popular vote. But it would take a constitutional amendment to change it, and it would be, you know, you have to have three-fourths of the states approve of a constitutional change. And so when you break it down into big states versus small states, you probably have the same kinds of arguments all over again.
Where do you come down on it? I know you want to be an NPA, but you must have an opinion at this stage of the game, knowing what you know. Which do
well,
you think works better?
Let me just put it this way. After every election, the party that loses is the one that wants Electoral College reform, and the one that wins doesn't. And I'll stop at that.
Okay. Fair enough.
Very clever.
It's
yes.
True.
So that's a way to go back to your distinguished career, Susan. I marvel at the different places you've spoken and the expertise you've offered. And I'm curious, as you look toward these days ahead of you, where do you feel drawn after the examples you've given us in a classroom? I would hope you'd keep doing these kinds of conversations. I know dialogue is important to you, but I'm curious from your stand, what do you see ahead after so-called retirement from teaching?
Retirement from teaching, from classroom teaching, but I will continue to teach through my public presentations and
great
media appearances. After all, 2018 is going to be one of the most exciting and interesting, fascinating, I'd say, midterm elections that our state has seen in years, in fact, in my lifetime. And I've already got a lot of speeches around the state scheduled. I'm very blessed to have those opportunities, and it certainly prompts me to keep up with all the statistics that you mentioned. But I just enjoy teaching to a broader audience. I'm a country girl. I grew up in Land O'Lakes, Pasco County. My family was citrus growers. My grandfather was a first permanent settler of Lutes. So I go way back to Florida roots that are deep, and it's really been very interesting to look at the state's transition. And I just like meeting with different kinds of groups and speaking to different kinds of people. If I just sat in my office all the time at USF and never went out of the classroom, I would never have been able to afford my students with so many internship and business and professional opportunities just from meeting people around the state.
Mm-hmm. Susan, I have to ask you, you mentioned how exciting this 2018 election is going to be, particularly here in the state of Florida. I'm concerned about this Russian interference that we all know about. You probably know way more about it than I do, but I think a lot of the general public is concerned that since the previous election, really nothing's been done to protect ourselves against this internal hacking through Facebook and Twitter and whatnot. I'm shocked that the federal government or state government aren't working diligently to try to allow every citizen that's going to walk into a voting booth feel like their vote will be legitimately counted, and that there will not have been some weird hokey-finokey stuff going on behind the scenes below everybody's sense of reality.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It is a concern to a lot of people, but I do work a lot with the Florida State Association of Supervisors of Elections, and I think that a lot of people don't understand that actually it's very, very hard, almost impossible to hack into and affect vote counts in our state the way that our system is set up. But I think that the supervisors know that this year in particular, they've got a big challenge that they have to better show people how the voting systems in Florida work. I think even more frightening now has become, and you've mentioned this, the whole involvement of social media and the use of it for dastardly purposes rather than the communication purposes that initially these kinds of social media were set up to encourage. It is frightening what's happening with Facebook, which is used by millions of people to the point of where even the Europeans are investigating it. And so it's not just the Russians. There's all kinds of dastardly deeds being done through social media to the point of where at a recent conference of political consultants in Washington, D.C., which I attended as a political scientist just to see what was going on, it was interesting that the professionals were even wondering about whether to advertise on, do online ads, worrying about, you know, these kinds of big social media type places, what they were going to do with the data and how accessible it would be to people who wanted to hack. But I think it's a huge problem right now in a lot of people's minds, and it is really up to election officials themselves to start giving people more confidence in the system.
Susan, we chose you because you are indeed such a game changer, and we're talking about the challenges coming up with these elections. What specific tools might listeners, individuals, do personally? Where can we take responsibility and say it's the government, it's the media, it's the something else? Where might I, Sharon Joy Kleitch, pay attention to be a better informed voter in fall 2018?
I think one of the best sources is to go to what we call in our business news aggregation sources, where you have all kinds of articles from all different sources together so that you can get different viewpoints. I personally like to go to realclearpolitics.com because for every storyline that's X, they have an equivalent storyline on the same topic that's Y.
Good.
And it gives you a better sense of being able to, at least when you're looking at other media, to sort out, okay, so this view comes from this particular view, you know, background of political activists, and the other from another. And, of course, I like a lot of the news aggregation sites in Florida where you can look at what every newspaper in Florida, what their political stories are for the day, to get a feel for something that's really broad-reaching versus something that's not. The bottom line is, you have to really go to multiple sources.
Okay.
And you can't just stay in your comfort zone of always looking at the same cable television station or reading the same newspaper and saying that's that. Really important. But I also think that it's really easy to do is to get a local election official out to a group meeting or whatever to explain the whole process and better understand it. Even I know some supervisors are planning even to get tours to show people how all of it works to increase the confidence that people might have in our system. So a lot of things can be done. I always say reform starts local and goes national rather than vice versa. So a lot of the communication changes and confidence building things come from building at the local community level up.
Mm-hmm. And talking about confidence levels, it makes me also think about gerrymandering. And I was really paying attention to the Pennsylvania Congressional District 18 because I'm from Allegheny County. And so I was staying up till like 2 o'clock in the morning to see what was going to happen there. And the bizarre thing or unusual thing about it is, even though the candidate I was hoping for did win, that because of a redistricting, that seat is actually going away. So, you know, we do see throughout the state of Florida and in other states where there are rather strange lines and crazy curly cues being drawn to create these districts that sort of seem like the particular party in power is making certain that they remain in power by drawing these bizarre districts. So what can we do nationally, and why did this even happen?
Well, a lot of it stems back to the, you know, several decades ago when the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the 90s that you had to draw a majority-minority district if one could. And, of course, Florida does have a sizable minority population. And so you saw, like, in that strange congressional district up in Jacksonville that looks like it's a ink splot, was drawn, and it covered several counties so that you could create a majority-minority voting district for, you know, majority black population. So what we have happen is, because minority populations tend to be concentrated in urban areas, you have, and each district has to be the same size, you have, you know, the, what they call, it makes the outer areas, suburban and rural areas, more districts whiter, and the urban areas more minority or more Democratic. The problem that you have with redistricting is that people aren't evenly distributed by party geographically across the state. For example, it would be really hard for me to draw a Republican district in Broward County or a Democratic district in, you know, Collier County, which is Naples, because people are increasingly choosing to live with like-minded people. And geographers have really been the first to point this out to political scientists, that some of the redistricting problems are the increasing desire of people to live with people who are politically like-minded, and there's nothing you can do about that. But there certainly are ways of dealing with ardent partisan gerrymandering, and we have a case right now before the U.S. Supreme Court, which is designed to be path-breaking. If they rule for the first time that partisan gerrymandering is illegal, and they have the criteria by which you would prove that it's illegal, that will totally change the redistricting process after the 2020 census.
I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch here with Cher Tanner, co-hosting Spotlight on Game Changers on WMNF The Source. And with us today is Dr. Susan McManus. Susan, I thought that Florida was one of the better states dealing with gerrymandering.
We have been a bit better. Of course, we passed the Fair Districts Amendments, which certainly helped a bit. And we are not as bad by any stretch as some of the others, again, because we are so diverse. And the other thing that's really makes it difficult with redistricting is, think of Florida, how much we grow. We're back to a 1,000 new people a week or whatever it is. You know, so you, if you have to rely upon the latest census, if we had to right now redraw districts like some places and use data from the 2010 census, it would be way out of whack for right now and violative of the one person, one vote criteria that you have to have equal-sized districts. It's a very complicated process. I hear so many people say, well, why can't you just put it into a computer and let it come out? Because if you did that, you'd have thousands of different iterations that you would be able to pick from. So anyway, it's a difficult process, but I think it has become elevated in political activist minds now because we're nearing the new census.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this court ruling, everybody's waiting on with bated breath because it could just totally change the whole dynamics of redistricting.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the basics of civics, Susan? I mean, the states are really bad. I think Florida's maybe one of the worst. And what kind of constructive things can you tell us are going on to bring back civic education? Because how can we be citizens if we don't know how to do it?
We have a crisis level when it comes to high school graduates' knowledge of our governmental system. It's one of the reasons that people are cynical or don't vote. It's a lot of ills that come out of an uneducated K through 12, you know, part of our constituency. We don't stress enough about state and local politics, so that's one of the reasons that younger people's voter turnout rates just plummet in a midterm and go up in a presidential, because they don't understand state and local government. And I think that you have groups that are avidly working on trying to improve civic education in the state.
Good.
The Bob Graham Center at the University of Florida and the Lou Fry Institute at UCF. And then you've got social studies teachers groups and whatever that are really avidly trying to improve civics. But I also think that we've got to get rid of this idea that you should not bring somebody who's an elected official into the classroom, because it might offend somebody's politics.
Oh, my goodness. Now, you're saying that's a rule?
We have quite a bit of that. We have quite a bit of that around the state where people... And the second thing that we just simply do not teach well is the basic Bill of Rights. What does it mean? What does freedom of speech mean? And be able to use examples. There needs to be better teaching materials for how to address that, those basic topics in K through 12, because, you know, a lot of people do not go on to college, and the extent of what they learn about government is K through 12.
Yeah, you brought up Bob Graham's wonderful work around civics and teaching people about that. And, of course, it then made me think of his daughter who's running for governor. How do you see that race unfolding in our state? And that certainly might bring some of the voters out that don't normally show up on these midterm elections.
Well, the Democratic side is very, very interesting because it reflects the diversity of the Democratic Party in terms of what we would refer to as somewhat identity politics. For example, Gwen Graham, of course, the female vote. Andrew Gillum, the black mayor of Tallahassee, the black vote. Phil Levine from Miami Beach, mayor there, now former mayor, the Jewish vote. And then you have Chris King, the young entrepreneur, never been in politics before, who has strong connections to the LGBTQ community through family. And so you have a very, very interesting Democratic primary that's shaping up. It's the most competitive, actually, set of primaries for governor that we've had in decades, because the Republicans have a couple of strong candidates with the possibility of a third one entering the race. You, of course, have Adam Putnam. And you have Ron DeSantis with the possibility of Richard Corcoran entering. But it is the first time in decades where both parties will have had extremely competitive primaries for governor, and the stakes are high because Florida's next governor will have a veto power over the congressional redistricting map that's drawn after the 2020 census. So a lot, and of course, Democrats have been losing governor's chairs across the country, so a big priority of Democrats nationally is to regain some of the governorships, and of course they see Florida as a potential pickup. Republicans, on the other hand, absolutely do not want to lose that executive post, and so it's shaping up to be what the last four big statewide elections have been here, another 1% margin of victory in the general election. However, I don't know the degree to which highly negative primaries from now till August will mean if it just gets so negative all the time, it may have the unintended consequence of tamping down turnout in the general election from some key parts of each party's base. So a lot of uncertainties, but a very exciting and interesting race.
And it's exactly why you're not going away as you retire.
That's right.
I want to ask you, Susan, I know that Sharon Joy sent you the 10 qualities of a game changer. And we really use those in choosing the guests for our show. And you certainly are a game changer. And we were wondering, did any of those resonate particularly with you?
Absolutely, especially the one that says that all life is connected. I think that everybody that's really trying to keep their finger on the pulse of our society comes to recognize that very, very quickly, especially in a diverse state like ours. And I thought the other one that sort of really resonated with me was the one where, you know, taking action that strikes at the root. And I do that through teaching and involving my students and encouraging them to be active citizens as they go through their careers and give back as opposed to taking. So I those two particularly really resonated with me.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And it's really crazy to think that we've come to the end of our time together here. We want to be able to have people get in touch with you, Susan, and learn more about your work, particularly as you leave USF so that you don't get lost. So how can they reach out to you?
They will always be able to reach me through USF, assuming that I get the emeritus status, because okay. we do keep our email for life. And
okay.
So they'll always be able to get a hold of me at mcmanus@usf.edu. And that's MacManus, mcmanus@usf.edu.
Terrific. And would you have any words of wisdom to now leave our listeners with as we go forward toward this 2018 election?
Stay active and be informed. It's not easy, but it's the responsibility of being a good citizen to make the effort. And by doing so, you'll feel like you've given the best you can to being an informed voter.
Lovely.
Brilliant. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you,
You're
Susan.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm very honored.
I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch, here with Cher Tanner, hosting our show, Spotlight on Game Changers, on WMNF, The Source. Today's guest was Susan McManus, Distinguished University Professor of Public Administration and Political Science at the University of South Florida. She can be reached at mcmanus@usf.edu, and that's spelled MacManus.
We thought it might be interesting to hear a few of the current Gravis Marketing polling numbers regarding some of the candidates and issues we touched on in our conversation with Susan. Here's Taylor with the Orlando Political Observer.
The race for governor remains tight. Gravis Marketing managing partner Doug Kaplan notes that on the GOP side, Ron DeSantis has gained in each poll. DeSantis trailed in December and February, but now he leads Adam Putnam 19-17% in March. Speaker Richard Corcoran's campaign continues to struggle to gain support. In each poll, he hovered around 2-3%. Undecided voters remain at 60%. The Democratic race continues to solidify into a three-person race between Gwen Graham, Philip Levine, and Andrew Gillum. Gillum rebounded a bit in March to 11% after falling from 12-9% from December to February. Graham continues to drop to 9% from her high of 18% in December, and the former mayor of Miami Beach, Philip Levine, has now gained his first lead in the Democratic primary. Levine's support has jumped from 6% in December to 13% in March. Since 64% of voters remain undecided, Democratic and Republican voters have yet to become engaged with their respective gubernatorial primaries at this point in time. The race on the general election side remains close. Putnam numbers remain stronger than DeSantis against Graham and Gillum. Putnam leads Gillum 34-28%, while he only leads Graham 34-32%. DeSantis trails both Gillum and Graham. The generic ballot remains tight in Florida, with 40% in favor of Democrats. Kaplan notes that, quote, Florida appears to be moving left on a host of social and cultural issues. Voters support a needle exchange program, poker, and gambling. And voters oppose a ban on transgender bathroom use, with 42% feeling transgender individuals should not be banned from using the bathroom of the gender they identify with. But they approve a ban on transgender locker room use. Support for gay marriage has decreased from 59% in support of in December to 51% in support of in March. After the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting in February, Gravis asked two new questions on gun control measures. Earlier this month, Governor Scott signed a bill that raises the minimum age for purchasing firearms to 21 in the state of Florida. This provision has broad support among Florida voters, with 76% in agreement. The measure is approved by 90% of Democrats, 78% of independents, and 61% of Republicans. Voters also support a ban on semi-automatic weapons, such as the AR-15, by 64 in favor to 31% who oppose the ban. In November, Florida voters will get a chance to pass a ballot measure to restore voting rights to felons who have completed their court-ordered sentence. 60% is the needed vote share to pass a constitutional amendment in Florida, and Gravis finds the amendment is supported by 63% of voters, with only 25% in opposition. Doug Kaplan said, quote, "This amendment seems like a done deal. Support is already over 60%, with 12% still unsure. The amendment is supported by the three leading Democratic candidates for governor and opposed by Adam Putnam on the Republican side. Ron DeSantis has yet to take an official stand."
So that was interesting, hearing some real statistics on the candidates that we spoke about with Susan, didn't you think?
Yes, it sounds like there's lots to learn of real news, real information.
I like that you said real news.
Yeah, educate ourselves as the electorate. And I was also taken with Susan's emphasis on needing more dialogue. I've certainly found that to be true. We've forgotten how to listen. We've forgotten to recognize how listening is a great value for us. Because if we only talk about ourselves and what we know about, where's there space to learn anything?
Exactly. And I loved her idea around, you know, when we come together when there's times of crisis.
Yes.
How we're not worried, is this person a Republican? Does this person support my candidate? We're just there as human beings. And it's in that ground, it's in that framework that we can actually have conversations with each other.
I'm struck by what Irma brought, among the other things, was a gift of that breaking down barriers where we just were looking out for our neighbors and other human beings. We cared for each other. We didn't care color, age, any other difference, but we were there to care for each other. In fact, I remember Susan talking about at the event I mentioned earlier, where she said her family's often divided on different political positions, but they're united in love.
Yeah, I didn't recall that. That's a beautiful comment. And I also appreciated thinking about the fact that here in Florida, it's truly an extremely diverse population. And so consequently, we have to realize that we have a lot of different interests, people wanting to get their own thing done, and we have to learn how to talk.
Susan's parting advice for us when it comes to voting was to be informed. So to wrap up today's show, we have a final audio clip of astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson discussing the importance of educating the electorate.
And it does not address the fundamentals of who's doing the voting, and what are people thinking who populate the countryside. Back to my earlier point, as an educator, I would much rather educate the electorate so that they can make an informed decision on their own about who they want to vote for. I will never tell anybody who or what to vote for, ever. Okay, I'm not even going to tell you what to think. About, you can have whatever belief system you want. I don't care, but you should be informed about the causes and effects of action and inaction and thoughts and non-thoughts about when you vote. Okay, so now let's say we have an educated electorate, a scientifically literate electorate. Doesn't mean everybody becomes a scientist, but you know what science is and how and why it works. Now you vote for who you want. And if you have a scientifically literate electorate voting, then you never have to come afterwards to the candidates they put in office and say, how come you don't know any science? Or how come you think this is true when, in fact, all emergent scientific research says it's not? That conversation would be over with. Because I don't want to have to keep running to Washington every 2 years when 88% of Congress gets swapped out to try to re-educate Congress. When it's the people who are voting for them that matter here in an elective democracy. As long as you have people voting, thinking one thing is true that is not. That is the beginning of the end of an informed democracy. And there's no telling where that country is going to go in the future, because what we know, as sure as day follows night, is that since the Industrial Revolution and before, innovations in science and technology are the engines of tomorrow's economies. The rest of the world knows that, whether or not we do. And in that world, we would convert a sleepy country into an innovation nation, thus assuring our health, our wealth, and our security. That's what I'm after here.
As Neil deGrasse Tyson and Susan McManus have suggested, stay active, be informed, and get ready to vote. That means register and vote in the primary in August and again in the general election in November. Thank you for listening. I'm Sharon Joy Kleitch, signing off for now. I've enjoyed being with you today and these past 6 months.
And I'm Cher Tanner, and we want to thank you for making our first season of Spotlight on Game Changers a tremendous success. We've created 26 unique shows during this season for your listening pleasure. And if you've missed any of them, you can listen to them at your leisure, either on our Facebook page at Spotlight on Game Changers, or on the archives on our WMNF homepage, which is WMNF.org/events/spotlight-on-game-changers. We want to give accolades and kudos to our engineer, Ira, whose tireless efforts have given this show its rich, high-quality sound, and he has always made sure that Sharon Joy and I sounded professional, polished, and poised. By the way, you can hear Ira on his unique music show, The Event Horizon, here on WMNF 88.5. Fill them in about the show, Ira.
It's a late-night, eclectic music show where just about anything goes.
Ooh, I like the way you said that. Now, if that voice doesn't get you hooked to hear him at the next Horizon, nothing will. And we want to acknowledge Eliza Gilkison's magical music, Beautiful World, which has brought us in and out of your lives each week over the last 6 months. And of course, we want to especially thank you for tuning in and listening and supporting our show. Until we meet again, I'm Cher Tanner, here with Sharon Joy Kleitch, and we hope to see you out there in the community being game changers.
Beautiful trees, breathing the air alive. Beautiful leaves, trembling and dry. Beautiful bees, moving from flower.